This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, we make a difference. Tonight, the people speak with Allison Weir. She's a freelance journalist and creator of ifamericansknew.org. If Americans Knew was originally founded by Allison, who traveled independently through the West Bank and Gaza in February and March of 2001. Ms. Weir found a situation largely the reverse of what was being reported by the American media. And upon further examination of this issue, she read dozens of books on the topic. And she found that the U.S. press portrayal was significantly at odds with information being reported by media throughout the rest of the world. Disturbed American citizens were being misinformed and uninformed on one of the most significant issues affecting them today, and discovered that the problem to be systematic. She founded an organization to be directed by Americans without bias and ethnic ties to the region, who would research and actively disseminate accurate information to the American public. Hi, Allison. Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. How are you this evening?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, it's our pleasure. Allison, I had the pleasure of meeting you. I just reminded her when she came to the Michigan area for a media conference event where you showed us an incredible and profound PowerPoint presentation, Allison, and spoke to members of the media at that day, and it's impacted me ever since. Although I had heard of the organization actually through another friend of mine on the internet, and one of the most important things that we gathered from it was what you called the media report card. Allison, can you talk to us about that?
Yes, I'd be glad to. What we've done at If Americans Knew is look at the a number of news outlets in the mainstream media, the most important ones that are, you know, have the largest viewership and readership. So we've specifically looked at the primetime news shows, all three of them, CBS, NBC, and ABC, as well as the New York Times and a number of other news media. What we've chosen to do is take a category that would be as clear as possible to analyze statistically. So we chose this category of how the media are reporting on deaths among both Israelis and among Palestinians, because it's our view they're all human beings and their deaths are you know, always tragic in every case. So we first had to determine how many people had been killed during the study period. And that was, of course, a very sad kind of thing to have to do. And then using that as our baseline, we could compare how the media had covered those deaths among both populations. And what we found was just profound distortion in the coverage. So, for example, with the mainstream television primetime news broadcasts, we found that the media were reporting on Israeli children's deaths, for example, at a rate up to 13 times greater than they were reporting on Palestinian children's deaths. We found that the Associated Press and the New York Times were reporting on young people's deaths when they were Israeli at rates up to 7 times greater than they were reporting on Palestinian children's deaths. So what's happening is Americans are receiving a great deal of coverage on Israeli deaths, especially sad category of young people's deaths. That is especially newsworthy and troubling because we all feel that children and young people are illegitimate targets of strife. They should not be killed in a conflict. Therefore, when we hear about their deaths, we're especially troubled by them and we especially remember them. Now, what we're finding is the U.S. media are reporting frequently and in great detail about the Israeli children who are being killed. Now, fortunately, this is a very small number of children, but it's seeming like a large number to Americans because we receive so many follow-up reports on the same death. Whereas Palestinian children who are being killed in far greater numbers, in 2004, for example, specifically I remember the number, they were killed at a rate 22 times greater than Israeli children.
And yet we're not reported.
Almost never are getting those reports, so most Americans have no idea that this is happening. And across the board, we're finding this kind of distortion. So that, for example, in 2004, because this is one of the years we did some of our studies, we found that the media were consistently reporting to Americans that the violence in the uprising, the violence in the conflict, was supposedly reduced, that basically it was a period of calm. Well, we discovered that for Israelis, happily, it was a period of calm. A very small number of people were being killed. But for the Palestinian population, it was the opposite. Their death rate had gone up even higher than it already was, and it was already quite high. So that in the year 2004, Israeli forces had killed, I believe it was 179 Palestinian children in that year, 179. During that year, Palestinian groups had killed a total of 8 Israeli children. And yet Americans hear about the Israeli tragedies, they just don't hear about the Palestinian ones.
Let me ask, you know, Allison, how does the media get away with this for so many years? I mean, I would think that eventually we would be able to harness some truth or garner some truth in media. How do they get away with this?
You know, that's the astounding part. And it's really a little bit, all of us are playing a role because we all need to do more to not let them get away with this. What's happening, it seems to me, is that the media, when on the rare occasions when they do report factually and accurately about the Palestinian situation, they receive a great deal of negative feedback, to put it mildly, from Israel partisans around the country. These Israel partisans are quite fanatic and active. They phone media that they don't like. They organize boycotts against media they don't like. That plays a major role. Also, of course, there are times when the news outlet itself is owned by someone or largely influenced by someone who's very friendly to Israel, that perhaps has Israeli citizen himself, or many, many members of the person's family might be in Israel, or there might be a documented record of this media owner or editor or writer contributing to Israeli causes. So, you know, no doubt that's playing a significant role in the kind of distortion we're seeing as well. But, you know, I feel that if more of us would be alert to this, and I'm guilty myself in the past, I had no idea this was going on. But as we learn that they are committing this kind of distortion and giving us this kind of biased coverage, we need to email the media and complain. We need to phone them and say we want full, accurate coverage we don't want, and we'll no longer accept distorted coverage. You know, just today I've been, again, working on a report by USA Today that was extremely inaccurate. They, journalistic ethics require that they run a correction on their report, and yet so far they are refusing to run a correction, even though they have been unable to prove that it's accurate, because it's not. It's a false report. It's in a story that USA Today ran about the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty. This was a very brutal, ruthless attack, and there is massive evidence from many different directions that the Israeli attack was an intentional attack. Yet, USA Today ran an article that claimed that it was not an intentional attack, and that stated that there had been, quote, 11 U.S. investigations finding that the attack was accidental. Well, that's a completely false statement. There have not, you know, it's completely false. There has been
so there have not been any investigations by any government agency or authorized individual investigation company.
Well, there was one pseudo investigation back in 1967. It was called the Naval Court of Inquiry into the attack. It was very quick, very limited. Did not include testimony by the crew members, which is bizarre. And that one very short investigation is the basis on which everyone says, oh, it was investigated and it was found to be accidental. Now, what is significant is, first of all, that investigation itself, as I just said, was very limited in its scope, extremely limited in its scope. As if that isn't enough to discount it, there's far more recent and more serious evidence to discount it, which is that its senior attorney on this investigation, Captain Ward Boston, a career naval officer, came forward a few years ago and made a public statement saying that they were ordered to cover up the facts on this issue, President Lyndon Johnson, and by his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara. You know, this is just, it should have been an explosive statement by a high-ranking naval officer with considerable detail to back it up. And yet, once again, we find USA Today making no mention whatsoever of the statement, making a statement that is incorrect. There were not 11 investigations. There was one, which has since been refuted by its own senior attorney. And yet,
if I'm not mistaken, Allison, I think the events took place on June 9th, because I know that there was just recently a memorial. There is a yearly memorial for the victims of the USS Liberty, that the families of the Liberty put on as a memorial and in protest of what they believe was an injustice.
Oh, yes. And, I was just there. There were three memorials on that weekend commemorating the crew members who were killed during that attack. And there were 34 of them were killed, and over 170 were injured, many of them extremely seriously. The decks were just running with blood. I am currently in the D.C. area, and I was at these memorials. One was at Arlington Cemetery, one was at the Naval Academy, and one was at the Naval War Memorial in Washington, D.C. These were very moving memorials. They were attended by a number of people with very high credentials, very important officials. And yet, this also was almost missing from U.S. media coverage. A few local places.
Well, exactly. I mean, I know I get my media, a lot of this information that I get does not come from outside sources. I get them from independent sources. Many of the particular announcement for this particular event of the commemorating the USS Liberty was sent to me by AAI, the Arab American Institute, and that's where I get a lot of my information about my country here, about America.
Mm-hmm.
I get it from organizations that are invested in not only healing other countries, but healing our own.
Yes, that's right. It's, it's astounding that we don't get newsworthy items from our own news media. And yet this is a prime example of a blatantly newsworthy episode, newsworthy statements made by high-ranking military officers. Some recent statements were made by a four-star admiral. He was the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He chaired an independent commission that announced its findings on Capitol Hill in October 22, 2003, stating that the government of Israel had committed an act of war against the United States of America, that two rescue flights to the USS Liberty had been recalled at the order of the President of the United States, which resulted in 25 young people killed who otherwise would not have been killed, and that these various sordid details of this incident were ordered covered up by the President of the United States. Now, these statements were not made by radicals. They were made by a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They were made by a commission that included on its panel General Ray Davis, who was the highest-ranking Medal of Honor recipient in the United States. They included a rear admiral who not too many years ago, was the head of the Navy Legal Department. You know, these are extraordinary statements.
Allison, when it comes to this type of information, here you are citing, as you said, credentialed Americans, admirals, generals, irrefutable in their nature.
Right.
How invested is Israel and the Israeli lobby in the United States in keeping these things under wraps?
They are extremely invested in that. I mean, the Israel lobby does not sleep. You know, they go after every little thing that they can. If there's a professor somewhere teaching his students accurately and fully the facts about Israel-Palestine, they attack the professor. As you know, Norman Finkelstein was just recently denied tenure at his university, despite the fact that his own departmental review gave him a sterling review and recommended that he be given tenure. Yet, because Professor Finkelstein has done very excellent work on Israel-Palestine and on other aspects of Israel and on the lobby in general, he was targeted. He was especially targeted by Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard law professor, whose credentials are very sketchy, I have to say, when you look at his writings about a number of aspects of human rights and international law. Alan Dershowitz targeted Norman Finkelstein. He pressured the president of his college, which was a Jesuit college, and yet the president of that college backed down, overruled his own department, and denied tenure to a professor who clearly had passed the review that's necessary to get tenure. You know, this is something we need, more Americans need to learn about. It's a very, very dangerous situation.
Which brings me to... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say the consequences are tragic for the Middle East, and they're extremely dangerous for Americans as well.
Well, your supposition in originally starting this website, Allison, was one of great faith in the goodness of Americans. And you believe that if Americans knew the facts, knew the statistics, they would respond differently to the events in the Middle East and Palestine, Israel. Do you really think that is happening?
Well, it's happening slowly. It's hard when the media across the board hides so much, you know, basically obscures so much information, so that people are continually getting very filtered information, very, very manipulative type of information. So that makes it difficult for those of us that are trying to get the full information out to the public. But the indications are that when Americans start to learn these facts, they do become very upset about what's going on. The most frequent question I get when I speak around the country is, what can we do about this? So I find that many people are upset about the facts once they learn them. I think many analysts feel that information on the USS Liberty is perhaps, for some people, the most significant information because it's so eye-opening. You know, people are continually made to believe that Israel is an ally of the United States, that Israeli interests and U.S. interests are basically one and the same, which, of course, is very untrue. But when Americans learn, wait a minute, the so-called ally attacked a U.S. Navy ship, tried to sink it with every man aboard, and then tried to cover up its attack. In addition, you know, think about when they claimed that it was a mistake, And yet, when the survivors asked for the compensation they were due for their injuries for this attack, when the U.S. government asked for compensation for a ship that was valued at $40 million, which had to be scrapped, Israel quibbled over the amount of money it would give. It gave, you know, the equivalent of pennies to the crew members' families of the crew members who died. And they gave, I believe it was $6 million to the U.S. government for a ship that was valued at $40 million. You know, these are
But they did actually give something back. So that in and of itself is an admission of guilt to a certain extent.
That's right. I mean, the best that could be claimed for Israel is that it was just extraordinarily careless. And through its extreme carelessness, it killed 34 Americans, injured 173 of them, it appears lately, and damaged beyond repair a U.S. Navy ship that it was through its extreme carelessness and negligence this happened. Now, that's pretty bad right there, but even that's hidden. You know, but they have admitted that. Basically, they've admitted that much. They don't put it that way, but that's the reality of what they're admitting. Now, what they're not admitting, but which there's evidence to prove, is that it wasn't carelessness. It was an intentional attack on a U.S. Navy ship. You know, this is a very strong statement, and it is well backed up. Anybody who questions what I'm saying, and I encourage people to question these statements, please go to our website, ifamericansknew.org, read the information we have on the website. If you go to the tab U.S. Interests, and on the left side you see a section about the USS Liberty, read the massive amount of information we have there from very reliable sources. Follow these links, go to the sources themselves, and see what, you know, if you find that what I'm saying is accurate. I encourage people to look into this.
Well, I agree, and the site, for me, this is one of my favorite sites to source to anyone that is interested in this kind of information, this electronic intifada. But this particular one, Allison, this is the area that I find it to be a value to myself as a Palestinian American. When you, as an American that had nothing invested in the Middle East, didn't even really... if I recall during your talk that day, you really didn't even know anything about the Middle East or the Palestine-Israeli area. And how was it that you just decided that you were going to do this?
Well, you're correct. I used to know very little about Israel-Palestine. My own ethnicity, I'm European-American. I have a Protestant Christian background. And like many people of that background, I had never really paid much attention to Israel-Palestine. You know, we all live busy lives, and I tend to focus on whatever I'm working on at the moment. And unfortunately, sadly, this is my own, you know, negligence, I never paid sufficient attention to Israel-Palestine. It was just part of a very large world that, you know, it's hard to know everything about. But what happened is when the current intifada started, and as you know, but perhaps some listeners don't know, that's just, intifada just means uprising. It's, you know, not anything alien to Americans who had our own American Revolutionary War. When this uprising began in fall of 2000, I happened to be the editor of a very small Northern California newspaper writing about local issues. So I didn't look at it as part of my job. But I just became curious about what this uprising was all about. Why were children throwing stones against tanks? What was going on? What was the history of this issue? And, you know, I decided to follow the news reports. And when I followed the news reports, I noticed, since I'm a journalist, I think you especially notice when you're getting one-sided reporting. And I noticed that's what I was getting. You know, I listened to NPR quite a bit, and I was, you know, continually hearing from Linda Gradstein, gave great details about the Israeli perspective, but who very rarely and gave very few details about Palestinians. that was the same for the San Francisco Chronicle, the New York Times. So because there's the Internet, I went on the Internet, began to research it there, and as you know, you can get the international reports from various media and from within the region itself, both Israeli reports and Palestinian reports. And when I began to get those, I was just appalled at the violence that was going on, at the number of children, Palestinian children, who were being killed. No Israeli children were killed at the beginning at all, happily, but many, many Palestinian children were being killed. Many of them were being shot in the head. I noticed then when I'd look at my, you know, typical American media, none of this was being reported there, or at least or very, very little of it was being reported. So after a few months of this, I was so outraged at what seemed to me probably the biggest cover-up I had ever seen in my life, and I've seen many. You know, as a journalist, we've seen a lot of governmental and corporate cover-ups, but this one seemed far more significant. So I finally decided just to quit my job as the editor of the Sausalito newspaper and travel over to the West Bank and Gaza as a freelance reporter to see for myself what was going on. And
what did you find?
I found enormous tragedy. I found enormous destruction. I went through residential neighborhoods that looked like that were in ruins in Palestine. In Israel, of course, you go through neighborhoods that just look normal. I went, you know, to a cafe in Israel and could sip a cappuccino, whereas in the Palestinian territories, people were being shelled. Hospitals had many, many children in them that had been shot. Homes were destroyed. People were being kept in little prisons. Basically, their towns often were prisons where they couldn't get from one town to the next because there were Israeli military in between preventing people from traveling. It was there was just enormous devastation. And I was aware, finally, at that time, that it was U.S. tax money that was creating so much of this devastation, because U.S. taxpayers give well over $8 million per day of our tax money to Israel, more than we give to any other nation on earth by far.
Absolutely. I hate to come to this point. I mean, I almost don't want to stop because I find everything that you're saying of such value and it reassuring, Allison, because we know the truth. And when people outside of our circle of activism, of Arab Americans, of people that are reaching out on radio shows such as the People Speak radio show, hear Allison Weir talk about this, we feel as if we are not alone in this battle again. And obviously, with all the events recently in the Middle East, it's been quite heart wrenching. It's hard to see the fruition of all of the elements that have been put into the Gaza Strip now coming to maximization, I think. We're going to be taking a break right now, and as soon as we do, we'll be able to come back and have some audience participation for those of you that would like to ask Allison a question. You can call in on our toll-free numbers, and I'll be announcing those as soon as we come back. Thank you very much. We'll be with you in a minute.
Hi, this is Randy Rhodes. You know, when Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held serious bipartisan investigations that did result in articles of impeachment. He resigned before he could be impeached, but strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war, lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court orders, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge, tortured, used illegal weapons, and targeted civilians. Ask your Congress member to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Got questions? The library has got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the People Speak Radio Show. We are here with Allison Weir, freelance journalist and creator of the now famous website, ifamericansknew.org. Welcome back, Allison. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
We have our first question from Mike, I believe. Mike, can you come and give us your question, a brief question to Allison, please?
Hi, Allison. Thank you for being on the show. When I heard you describe yourself as just another American who was ignorant about the Israeli-Palestine issue, it pretty much describes me, or described me, because nothing bored me more than discussion about the Middle East. Nothing bored me more than discussion about Israel-Palestine until I became very much, you know, involved, like so many Americans, because of 9/11 and the war in Iraq. Could you perhaps talk about how 9/11 is in part perhaps retribution for America's support of Israel, and how, in fact, the war in Iraq is also connected to that? Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for your comment and your question. It's true that for so many people, the subject matter of the Middle East and Israel-Palestine is boring, largely because it's so confusing to us. You know, the media never report the context. They rarely give maps. They certainly never discuss the history, although the few times that they do discuss the history, they get it wrong anyway. And so it's sort of like watching, you know, for me to watch something like cricket would be boring because I have no idea what's going on. That's what it's like for most people watching this far more serious situation in the Middle East. We don't have the context, and our media never supply that. But you're right. More and more people, because of 9/11, are now making the effort to look into what is going on in the Middle East, and at the center of it, you find the core issue of the Middle East, which is Israel-Palestine. So because of 9/11 and that extreme tragedy, it has wakened up, even though it has been, that tragedy has been used by the Bush administration and by others to commit even more tragedy and create even more loss of lives, both of Americans and, of course, especially people in Iraq and throughout the Middle East and Central Asia. That incident, that event, also woke many Americans up who have a little more ability to look into the facts, are more honest, and began looking at Israel-Palestine and have been horrified at what we've discovered. As you've suggested, certainly U.S. support of Israel has earned us extreme dislike throughout the Middle East and throughout much of the rest of the world. When people are aware, as people in the Middle East are, of what U.S. money to Israel is paying for, it is horrifying. As I've mentioned earlier, Israeli forces have a record of killing a great number of civilians, many of them children. They have a record of committing atrocities in the occupied territories, Palestinian prisoners being kept in Israeli prisons, and there are, I believe, about approximately now 10,000 of them being held in Israeli prisons, are often being held without any trials, without any charges, and are being treated with physical abuse. Some of the people being held in these Israeli prisons, in fact, are American citizens of Palestinian ancestry, and they have been tortured. Now, this sounds like an extreme statement, but please just go to Foreign Service Journal, where you can read an article documenting what I've just said. So So the fact that U.S. taxpayers, through our taxes and through our government, are supporting Israel's brutality against Palestinians, this, as you might guess, makes us severely disliked throughout the region and is the source of potential attacks on the United States, on Americans here. You know, when you are originating misery elsewhere, the people that are suffering will eventually strike back at the origination of their suffering. And unfortunately, it's the United States that is the source of the money and often the weaponry that is creating their suffering. So U.S. policies of supporting Israel are placing American citizens at great risk, at just enormous risk. And anybody, you know, if perhaps you don't care about people across the other side of the world, I hope you will. I do, but, you know, if you don't care about people on the other side of the world, Americans should at least care about their own children and their own communities and be aware that these misguided U.S. policies are placing American children at risk as well as Palestinian children.
You know, and for those of you interested, you may call to ask questions of our guest toll-free at 877-270-8714. That, once again, 877-20-8714. And our international community can dial in at 888-861-3519. Allison, one of the things that that people are saying about what's happening in the Middle East right now, obviously the insanity of and the complete and utter failure of both Afghanistan and Iraq, what's happening now and is perceived as a failure in Palestine, the failure of the Lebanon falling apart again. What people are seeing in the community, in the world community, is this is a failure of American policy. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's certainly a failure of a rational American policy. Some people are worried perhaps it's the culmination of what certain segments within the American government have been pushing for. If you look, for example, at Elliot Abrams, who has increasingly become an influential advisor in the Bush administration, he has a track record of supporting military aggression, of a very ruthless approach to pushing policies that he feels will benefit Israel. And among the types of policies that this type of person has frequently pushed is the destroy the surrounding nations that could potentially at some future time be a competitor to Israel, perhaps challenge Israel and perhaps try to work against Israeli abuses of human rights and maybe stand for the human rights of Palestinians. So there's an aspect to Israeli policies that's often especially hidden in the American media. Bad as the media's coverage is, this aspect of it is even worse. And that's the connection of the neoconservatives to U.S. policies in the Middle East. And the earlier questioner had brought up the question of the Israeli connection to the war in Iraq, and I hadn't gotten to that, but this is part of that as well. Because there's a great deal of evidence when you look into U.S. policies in the Middle East. What is important to do is to look at who pushed which policies, what were the memos that were written, which administration officials were pushing for which policies. And you can look into that. Some excellent researchers have done that for us. And they found that the people that most pushed for the war in Iraq, that most claimed that somehow this would be good for U.S. interests, that were very instrumental in fabricating some of the so-called evidence of weapons of mass destruction that were used to try to convince the American public that we needed to invade Iraq, the people who pushed all of that were neoconservatives with strong ties to Israel. people like Douglas Feith, who was the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense in the Pentagon, a political appointee. I don't think this man ever served in the U.S. military. So he was at the top of the Pentagon, but he was certainly not a military officer. Not long before had been writing
Allison, isn't that strange in and of itself?
Pardon?
I was saying, isn't that strange in and of itself?
It is. It is. It is extremely strange. When I first discovered this aspect back in 2001, when most people were not yet writing about the neocons, and certainly were not telling about their connections to Israel, I had the good fortune of reading an excellent book written by Kathleen Christensen, who is a former longtime CIA analyst. Now she's become an anti-war activist, but she, you know, has very strong analytical abilities, and wrote a book called Perceptions of Palestine. It was published by the University of California Press, is very little known to most people, but in that book she has a great deal of information about Douglas Feith and the other neocons that have been pushing Israeli policies within the U.S. government.
Just amazing. All right, we have another question here, Allison. I'm sorry. Matt from, I'm not sure where Matt is from. Matt, will you come to the mic and please give Allison a brief question?
Yes, I'm Matt from Wichita, Kansas. Allison, with the current events with Hamas being taken over, what is your opinion on it? And what's your opinion on the Iraqi war with Israel?
Well, the current situation with the really almost civil war that's been going on just lately in mostly in Gaza is just, of course, enormously tragic, and is the result of Israeli policies and American policies. This has been being written about quite a bit in the international media, but not very much in the American media. What happened, as you'll recall, is the Palestinians had a democratic election. Despite a great deal of interference from Israel, they did manage to hold what seemed to be a democratic, fairly successful election in which Palestinians cast their ballots. Now, Palestinians decided to cast their ballots for Hamas. They had had Fatah as the governmental leadership for many years. During those years, their conditions had grown considerably worse over the years. In addition to that, Fatah was accused of corruption among Yasser Arafat and a number of its officials. And given those two conditions, a population usually goes for the dissenting party, the party that has a record that does not show corruption, and that claims it will do a better job than the party that has ruled during a period when economic and physical conditions grew steadily worse. So people voted for Hamas. Some of the Hamas candidates, by the way, this is often not known, were actually Christians. It was a more diverse party than people think, and the voting for it was more diverse than people think. So they had a Hamas government. Israel didn't like that, and the U.S. government, which largely does what Israel wants, and especially when it contains neoconservatives who are continually pushing the Israeli agenda, decided that they would then pressure Palestinian population because they didn't like the way the Palestinians voted. Money was cut off. Money that had gone to Palestinian humanitarian organizations was cut off. Israel, which holds to a sort of strange situation, gets a lot of the tax money that belongs to Palestinians, refused to turn that tax money over and held that tax money. The European Union went along with this pressure and is also cut off humanitarian aid to the Palestinian population. As a result, Palestinians, especially in Gaza, which with the disengagement became one large concentration camp, a prison that people couldn't get into and out of without Israeli permission, that couldn't get food and medical supplies into without Israeli permission, started to starve, literally. People were starving. Conditions grew progressively worse with this kind of blockade of humanitarian supply and food. And given that kind of condition and the fact that there was probably infiltrators within Gaza as well, after a while, people, gets to be a point where there will be the inevitable internal strife, where some people will say, listen, Hamas, yes, you were elected, but because the U.S. and Israel doesn't like your election, now we're all starving, so we want you to step down. Other people would say, no, you know, Hamas should not step down. We elected them. We're not going to give in. Hamas, you know, would say, no, we're not going to give in. So there was more and more conflict. It eventually became more and more violent as conditions grew more and more desperate until we see what we're seeing today.
And, you know, a lot of people, Allison, will say things like, Palestinians are not willing to accept responsibility. Of course they're willing to accept responsibility. But the vacuum that was created, the chaos mm-hmm. that was established, the lack of credibility for any elected official in Palestine by due to the fact that Israel disrespects and discounts every administration that's ever been in, has been the fertilizer for this kind of reaction.
That's right. That's exactly the case. It's very, very incorrectly being reported quite often because, for example, Hamas, as you know, and I'm sure many of your listeners know, but most Americans don't know, had a truce with Israel for over a year in which they had refrained from any violence and from killing Israelis, despite the fact that during that period Israel consistently invaded Palestinian territories and killed numerous Palestinians of all ages and backgrounds. Hamas has actually, despite its reputation pushed by the U.S. media, has been consistently reasonable in the statements that it has made. It has been far less violent than Israel has been, and yet Americans are not receiving these types of facts. You know, we continually hear that, quote, Israel refuses to we continually hear the charge that Hamas refuses to accept Israel's right to exist. And yet, we never examine what that statement means. And the media never examined the fact that Israel never recognizes Palestine's right to exist. You know, the reporting is limited, it's distorted, and it's filled with Israel spin.
We have one more question here from an audience member. Let me, if you would come to the mic, give us your name and where you're calling from. A brief question for Allison, please.
I'm Ray in Florida. I just want to know what you think about the influence of such celebrities as John Hagee, Pat Robertson, and the late, Jerry Falwell. Don't you think that dispensationalism that they believe in, that's a certain doctrine that their church teaches, or that they themselves teach, has had great influence upon the American U.S. policy towards Israel in order to fund them and to ignore the fact that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinians?
Yes, that's an excellent point. And certainly those individuals you've mentioned have played a very, very negative role in the United States of America. For anybody that wants a country that's moral, that's practical, that follows principles that, you know, many of us believe are in the Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence. But, as you say, Jerry Falwell, for example, was very pro-Israel. Now, I don't think it's a coincidence that he especially became pro-Israel when Israel gave him a jet plane that allowed him to travel around and become more powerful and more influential with America.
I never knew that. That's very interesting.
There's been an alliance at the top between people like Jerry Falwell and Israeli leaders. It's it's true that there is a very strange interpretation of Christianity called dispensationalism that interprets the Bible to say that all Jews should go back to Israel, and then there will be a certain number will convert to Christianity, the rest will be killed in a horrible combat, and that this will somehow bring the second coming of Jesus. It's a very odd interpretation. It completely leaves out the teachings of Jesus, which one would think would be at the center of any kind of Christianity teachings, but it's held by people like Jerry Falwell. Now, what's interesting is that this interpretation has actually been around for a long time. I think it's been over 100 years that there has been this dispensationalist interpretation. However, in the past, it was very, very, very small number of adherents. It was a very fringe movement that most people had really never heard of and did not embrace. It's not until Israel became a state and that Israeli Zionists were pushing everything they could to get American support that groups that were willing to believe this type of interpretation and individuals that were willing to teach this type of interpretation started getting support to do that. And as a result, their numbers grew. Until now, there are many people that seem to believe it. Again, I find that many of these people, given the full facts on the issue, and who read more parts of the Bible than just these few parts of, a few verses here and there that support that kind of interpretation, pretty quickly are willing to discard it or to reconsider what it means in a longer term when they get more facts on what Israel's doing, what the facts are there, and learn more about the fact that there are Palestinian Christians that are there in Bethlehem and what's being done to them.
Which is a fascinating situation in and of itself. We have a couple more guests that we're going to try to get in here. Derry from Connecticut, can you give us your question for Allison, please?
Hello, Allison. Thank you for being with us tonight. My question is, Allison, do you believe that Israel is supporting Fatah as they believe they're easier to control than Hamas? Thank you.
I couldn't hear that very well, but I think the question was whether Israel was supporting Fatah, and what was the rest of it?
Supporting Fatah against Hamas, I believe.
Okay.
In the breakup with Hamas.
Yes. Well, certainly Israel and the U.S. have been supporting that side of the internal conflict. The U.S. there's evidence and, a great deal of evidence about the U.S. giving money and weaponry to Fatah to use against Hamas. I think that there's a history of Israel using divide and conquer tactics. So originally, for example, the PLO was and is a very secular movement. Yasser Arafat, from the very beginning, was calling for, believe it or not, but look this up, was calling for a democratic, secular state with equal rights for Muslims, Christians, and Jews. So this was a very secular, nationalistic movement. To try to counter that and undermine it, Israel then, for a period, threw some support to Hamas, which is a Muslim-based movement. So for a while they were supporting Hamas and sort of feeding some money in through various means to Hamas to build it up. now that Hamas is popular and has power and has shown itself willing to take steps that could be important ones, now Israel is pushing Fatah, and the U.S., again, following Israeli directions, is also pushing that. You know, I think that it's partly that this is to, you know, keep the dissension going, to build up both sides against one another. There are certainly elements within Fatah and the leadership that have been willing to go along with this kind of support from Israel and from the United States. So, you know, I think it's this type of strategy that we're seeing once again. And the support goes back and forth according to what Israel feels are in its interest to support. It did this with Lebanon back in the 80s, where it you know, and before that, pushing different elements within Israel that would lead to internal strife. It's done that again recently in Lebanon, again pushing different elements that will lead to internal strife. A lot of this has been written about in some excellent books by people like Donald Neff and by Kathleen Christensen. So it's a long-time strategy, and I think we're seeing it, you know, once again.
Well, I want to thank you, Allison, for being with us tonight. Again, please continue your important and valuable work. As a Palestinian-American, I can't begin to tell you how enheartened we are when we know that Americans are finding out the truth through Americans and not through Arabs. You're a very popular guest here. Thank you again very much. We cite your, and again, the site is www.ifamericansknew.org, so you can go there and find out all the important information that you will not see anywhere else. Thank you again, Allison. Next week's guest, folks, on Tuesday night is Arlo Guthrie, famous artist and singer and songwriter. We also have a special show coming up on Thursday. Faluha Boud Umara and Hashmia Mohsen Hosseini are Iraqi labor leaders, both here on tour talking about what is going on in Iraq. And we will have translation available. It's going to be a very important show. Thank you all for being with us tonight. And again, thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
It has been an honor having you on The People Speak.
Thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the river by the relief fountain, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
Just thank you, Bassima, and thank you, Seth, and thank you all the admins and everybody else for coming. I just wanted to correct something there. Arlo Guthrie is going to be our guest sometime next week. We're trying to decide, they're trying to figure out when Arlo Guthrie can do it. He likes to talk in the morning, which would be around 7:30 p.m. Pacific, 10:30 p.m., a.m., I mean, Eastern, and we don't have the radio services available at